can rebroadcast this out on LinkedIn. So hopefully it's going out now.
Okay.
And then in post-prod, I might need to take them out and stitch these things back together. So, so sorry about that.
No problem.
Honestly, I was shocked. The only time that kind of thing's happened before where it's kind of just cut with no like recovery possibility was actually when I accidentally ended the broadcast. But in this case, I didn't do that. It was literally just, you know, it just stopped on us. So apologies for that, folks, but we're back and hopefully we can carry on the chat. And I think what we're talking about, Caroline, we're talking about the product side of things. And in particular, I was interested in, you know, do you enjoy that part of the CEOing bit? And part of the, you know, CEO is like your big, broad range of activities. But at the early stage of a business, maybe, you know, one of the key things is actually doing the building of the product and speaking to the customers and figuring out what all that's all about. Is that a part that you enjoy to do, Caroline? Or is it something that actually you had to do because no one else is doing it? And then, you know, someone else stepped in at the end, or you're looking for someone to step in?
Yeah, that's my favorite part, actually. So I suppose like my day to day, like my main focus is customer support. And I love that aspect of the business because I love, you know, talking to the customers and, you know, figuring out, you know, where the trip points in the product are. And then I also, I work on the tech team. So I'm not a technical person, you know, per se, but I would kind of look at more the kind of product side of things. So, you know, I'd be sprint planning with the team and our head of tech, Douglas, who's been with the company since, you know, our inception. So we would kind of work together on kind of mapping out, you know, when things are built, and kind of planning each then sprint with the team. And I would then sit on the weekly sprints and we'd kind of discuss the different features. And that meeting would include the development team as well as the design team and the customer success team. So we would all kind of talk about any kind of bugs or issues that customers are having on the system. And then we'd also talk about, you know, new features that are planned. And the design team would obviously then, you know, talk about, you know, how that's going to look and what the user experience would be like. And I love that side of the business. I really enjoy it. It's kind of something I've naturally gravitated toward. It's not something that when we set out, I kind of would have planned for myself or even, you know, not that I wouldn't have considered it, but it just kind of, you know, naturally fell that way. And I suppose outside of that, a big focus would be, you know, financial management, budget management, financial planning, and then coordinating the different teams when it comes to our overarching company strategy.
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting you mentioned how you gravitate towards certain activities. And I think that's very true of someone who's got a generalist role, like a CEO obviously has a generalist role. But inevitably, you end up spending more time on the stuff that you enjoy and you're good at. And you kind of spend less time on stuff that causes you some anxiety, or, you know, this is admin, I don't like to do it, or team management, you know, I don't like this. And then eventually you'll move into a certain space. So it's good that you recognize that these are some of the areas that you have some natural strengths in, I guess. Going back to advising these proto CEOs of recruitment technology businesses, I think, you know, they're going to go and do these things. What was kind of a key expectation gap that, you know, maybe you had when you first launched this product and first became, you know, moved out of recruiting and moved into recruiting tech? Was there an expectation gap that you hit and you thought, all right, this is the reality of it? And, you know, this young person now, or whoever, it could be an old person, but any person who's thinking about doing it, like, they need to know that this is actually the reality of what it is to try and build recruitment technology.
Yeah, like there were certainly many. I think, you know, like I think particularly in Ireland, like you hear, because it's such a tech hub, you hear about all these unicorns and, you know, these businesses raising X, Y, and Z being acquired. And, you know, just, it's kind of like the Hollywood lights, you know, of startups. You're looking at them and they're so bright and shiny. And when in reality, you know, everything happens, you know, much slower. You know, you kind of expect, you know, why wouldn't they buy our product? Of course they will. Everyone will buy it. And, you know, after a year, we'll have done this. And, you know, it doesn't quite happen that way. And I think that's the challenging part. And I remember very early on in our journey, my father gave me the best bit of advice. I always share it. He said, you know, if it was easy, everyone would do it. And that's really it. You just need to persevere, work hard, and and just stick with it, because it does take a lot longer, and you know that the highs are really high, the lows can be, they can be low. So having a good co-founder as well is, you know, where you can balance each other. Like, been so lucky to have such an amazing co-founder, David, and I think we've certainly over the years balanced each other. You know, when one was feeling low, the other was able to bring that person back up. And you know, our skills are quite complementary, where we've naturally fallen into, you know, being able to split the business quite comfortably, and but being able to cover everything as a whole in terms of, you know, using our strengths to the best advantage.
Yeah, I think a couple of points that's worth touching on here, Caroline. Firstly, the stuff you read in the news tends to be either amazing news or terrible news. Yeah. It's either a scandal that's some, you know, some toxic culture story that's happened, or on the positive side, somebody's raised this amazing amount of money or whatever it is. But those are really like exceptions to the rule, really. The vast majority of people doing a recruiting technology are just like people doing any kind of business. There's a lot of grind. There's a lot of stuff happening that no one ever sees or reports about, because it's hard work, it's hard yards. And you know, if we focus only on what we see in the news, we can get a very skewed idea as to what reality really is. And you know, maybe that itself is a good reason for people to try and experiment with some of this, because it's educational to try and just do this stuff without sort of being told what it is. Give me a couple of lessons you've learned on the entrepreneurial path, Caroline, that you can say, okay, these are actually good lessons to kind of have and hold going forward, things that you've learned in the last 5 years. So not kind of denigrating or any experience in recruiting before then, but stuff that you knew specifically, particularly from launching and running OccuPop, that you didn't know before.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, always, but particularly at the beginning, it's really about the graft. So like, I think don't waste time on, you know, trying to set up, you know, big boards of directors and, you know, have all of these, you know, bells and whistles, because it just complicates things. I think, you know, get out there, sell, prove the model, and then start to think about, you know, the minutiae at a later stage. I think a lot of people forget that, and you can lose a lot of time, you know, trying to build the perfect product. Like when we went to market with, which it was BidRecruit at the time, we've since rebranded, but it was such a pared back version of what it is now. And you know, we could have spent another 2 years building what we thought the market wanted, but actually once we got out and started selling, you know, the customer started, you know, dictating, and the market itself started to dictate, and the product actually went in quite a different direction than we had originally planned. So I think, you know, don't be afraid of change, be prepared to pivot and embrace it. Have a really strong team of advisors, you know, that aren't necessarily associated with the company as, you know, a board, but just, you know, mentors, either, you know, for me, you know, people I've worked with in the past, you know, or just, you know, friends I've made over the years have just, you know, become really valuable to me in terms of providing advice along my journey. And you get what you give. You know, I've often you've been really open with my time, giving back any advice I can share, because I've been so lucky to get it, you know, over the years myself.
You know what, Caroline, you've said something I want to talk about straight away, to be honest, which was this idea that sometimes you can be kind of lost in all of the, it's almost like displacement activity, isn't it? It's procrastination in some respects. It's failure to bite the bullet and just get the stuff in front of a customer and see how they react to it. You know, we have to almost do it with a sense of not knowing, and with quite exposed, because the customer or the person who's using it might turn around and say, actually, Caroline, that's terrible. What the hell are you doing? But yeah, you have to kind of have the ability to absorb that. And that can't be the thing that frightens you, because if it does, you just go back to your shop and keep building this thing, and then you don't know what is good or bad.
Exactly.
There's a really interesting, I forget who it was that was on Twitter that mentioned this, some sort of startup guru, but he said something that was actually really quite interesting, which was one of the best ways to discover your product is actually to get a product out and then see how your customers misuse it. So in other words, see how your customers actually behave with this thing, and what are they improvising with your tool that will tell you where the need truly is. So, you know, you may have product A, as you say, it's something that you've put some thought into. It's not something you've casually thrown out, but you have to be prepared to see, look, if these customers seem to be using this in a way that we didn't think they'd use it, but they're using it in this way, that may be the path that we go towards because the market is telling you what it needs.
Exactly. You discover things that, you know, you may not even have been aware of. Which I think is really valuable. And I think, you know, the mistakes you make at the beginning are a lot cheaper than the mistakes you could make later on. They tend to get, as you know, the business grows, the mistakes can be much more costly. So it's important to make those mistakes early on. And God knows we made loads and, you know, we're better for it. And yeah, I think, you know, you just need to kind of go, even if you feel like the product isn't ready. Like if 10 customers turn you down, there's another 10 to chase. You know, I think, you know, that's the biggest thing to, the biggest hurdle to get over is like, you know, that fear of rejection. It's like, oh, but like 100 people might reject it, but then the next 100 people might give you a thumbs up. So it just kind of keep, again, it comes back to perseverance.
Yeah, it's maybe that's an element where recruiters may have a quality because being resilient is, I think, something you need as a recruiter.
Definitely.
And certainly, you know, kind of inuring yourself to rejection. It's like a terrible thing. But as a recruiter, you're going to get a lot of no's. I mean, that's, you're going to get it from candidates. You're going to get it from hiring managers. You're going to get it from, you know, if you're doing BD, you're going to get it from prospects and stuff. Mm. So no's is, and sometimes a very harshly delivered no's as well.
Yeah,
we've been there, right? I mean, all of this stuff, I think, is good training at one element of being an entrepreneur in recruitment technology. It's one of the strengths. I think some of the weaknesses, though, maybe the lack of roundedness, I wonder, because recruiting can be a very, like, narrow skill set. Like, there's a certain two or three things. If you're really good at that, you have deep skills in, you could probably be a super successful recruiter, but you don't necessarily have a rounded business awareness or business knowledge. Would you say that's true, Caroline?
I disagree with you in a sense. Like in my experience, you know, the agency I worked with, you were responsible for your own desk, your own industry. So you, for example, the industry I recruited in was quality assurance and test automation. So, but you have to build that desk yourself and you have, you know, your annual targets that you need to meet and you're building your pipeline of, you know, customers that want to fill the roles. You're building your network of candidates and you kind of have that end-to-end responsibility of meeting those targets. You know, in different agencies it can differ because you can be part of, you know, one team covering the whole industry and it's more of a shared balance, but in my experience anyway, you almost had your micro enterprise yourself and it was your brand, it was your name that was going out along with the company brand. But yeah, it can be a little bit siloed as well. And I think, I suppose for myself anyway, I know that my experience in university and doing a lot of research and writing pieces, you know, at the time I thought this will never serve me anything, but actually it was so beneficial when it came to writing business plans and presenting them to investors. So I think, you know, from, I was able to lean on previous experience as well a lot and bring it into this role, and then a lot of upskilling as well.
That's right, because you've done other stuff before recruiting, didn't you? You when you were a journalist or something, and then you some teaching, I think, or something like this.
I did, yeah. I suppose a big passion of mine is writing, and I suppose I pursued that in university and followed that as a career, and ended up in Spain and set up a language school for kids, and it was kind of learning through play. And I really enjoyed that, and it was only, I suppose, when I came back to Ireland and I decided I wanted to work in more of a corporate environment. And, you know, I had a cousin working in recruitment and we had kind of chat a lot about it. And I just, you know, it was something that appealed to me. And I got into the industry. And that's really what introduced me to the world of tech recruitment. And, you know, that's where I suppose Occupop started.
You know what? I think it's great that you have all of these other skills as well. What a lot of people are talking about writing as being a very important skill in the modern world, particularly with the shift to remote and all this type of stuff, that your written communication is now even more important than it has ever been before, because you might be interacting with people at you know, you may never meet. You know, you can't rely on the idea, oh, we're going to bump into this person, or we're going to see him on Monday or whatever. It may not be the case. So your ability to write in a way, a communication message, but also is sensitive to audience and sensitive to how people feel about how they're going to be receiving that message is really important. What would you say to again, new CEOs coming up, like, is there a way in which they could get better at writing? Or is it something that, you know, at age of 16 or whatever, this is it, you know, this is how good you're going to get?
No, I think anyone can learn anything, improve on anything if they put their mind to it. Like, I do a lot of reading. I think reading, you know, will certainly help improve with writing. And particularly if you're, you know, if you're going to be reading text message after text message and just shorthand, it's not really going to serve you. But, you know, certainly, you know, choosing, you know, news pieces to read and then, you know, novels to read will certainly help improve, you know, your language skills, your written skills.
That's a very good point. Like your consumption in will actually improve your output in terms of the written word. And again, even so writing is something I've kind of been a little bit more interested in of late, simply because there's been some interesting thinking around how writing can improve actually your thinking as well. It's not just a case of producing words for other people to consume, but the challenge of being able to formulate your arguments actually helps discipline your thinking. So there's a lot of sloppiness in how we think and consider things, but if we have to actually write it down and explain it to somebody, or even further, we have to write it down and persuade that person, actually that really sharpens your thinking in a significant way.
Believe it. I've loads of notes written out here to help with this interview anyway, so hopefully it's paying off.
You're absolutely natural at this, Caroline. So, you know, you probably don't necessarily need the notes, but I appreciate you doing them in any way. Caroline, a lot of folks don't know this, but you're also a parent and a parent of two young children, not only one, but two young children. So that's fantastic and great to hear. But some people might be surprised to hear it because they're saying, you know what, company's been going 5 years. Caroline's got two young children, so probably had two kids in that time frame. How is that possible to do? And, you know, what was the thinking behind it? Like, how much of the family building went alongside the business building? Did those plans kind of weave together, or were they kind of running parallel?
We set out with the to start the business first, and, you know, we were working on the business and then, you know, started a family. So I suppose they have been running parallel. And I know we had kind of mentioned before, Hung, like, you know, there's never a perfect time. I think if we had planned, you know, around the business, we'd probably still be planning. So I think you do need to kind of just, you know, put 2 feet in and jump in and go for it. It's not without its challenges, but you can certainly make it work. And I think, I suppose, the benefit, like, particularly since the pandemic, there's been a huge shift, you know, in my view, on work-life balance and, you know, what's kind of measured in terms of, you know, output. And for me, you know, what that has meant is that, you know, my day hours are slightly shorter, so I can spend more time with my children. And then I'm able to, you know, pick back up later on in the evening, you know, when the tech team are online, because they're in a different location. So I'm able to balance things a lot easier than, you know, previously, before the pandemic, when I would have tried to squeeze everything in, you know, to a specific time frame. So I think, yeah, certainly from a parent perspective, the pandemic has been a huge positive impact.
You know what? You've got such a great facility with language, Caroline, because the words you use to describe, I think, the experience is just spot on. When you're in that 9 to 5, 5 days a week, it is a condensation of time, isn't it? Like, you're squeezed into these boxes. And that suits a person that doesn't have a lot of responsibilities. You know, if you can be the person that literally is on there at 8:30 to 5:30 every day for 5 days, rock solid, great. But what is that person? It's unlikely to be a parent with two young children. You know, it's optimized for someone who isn't this, or it's optimized for someone who doesn't have primary responsibilities for caring for kids in this way. So, The pandemic, I think, or more so the shift to remote, I think, which is a result of the pandemic, has enabled us to just flex that time throughout the week a bit more. Like, we have more than 40 hours a week. I forget how many hours we do have, but 24 hours to 7 days is up something like 100 plus hours, right? So we have that degree of time, obviously take away the time with sleeping, etc. And what you're saying is, what you've been able to do with this shift to remote is you can still do your day's worth of work. You just do it in different chunks. It's not like just one 8 hour long sprint, but you can do 2 hours here, 3 hours there, maybe 6 hours there, whatever it is. You can do all of that and still maintain all of the things you need to do outside of the immediate responsibilities of work.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's been coming for a while. I think a lot of companies, you know, some of the more, you know, advanced or evolved companies would be very focused on, you know, output rather than, you know, clock watching. And I think the pandemic and, you know, the move to remote work has really forced that through for the majority of companies. And I think it's a much better, you know, way to measure activity. And I think it creates a much happier workforce. Like, I know, you know, on my team, for example, there are people who like to just, you know, fit within the core set of hours and get things done. And then I have other people who prefer to come online at 9 o'clock, you know, doing work during the day and come back on at 9 o'clock. Maybe they're a bit, you know, early in the morning or late in the afternoon, they have downtime where they're just not doing their best work. So they take a break and then they come back on later. And I think, you know, that's a much better way to view things, and I think ultimately, you know, performance and output is much stronger that way.
You know what, that really leads us to think that how many people who optimally would have worked that way might have just struggled with the traditional 9 to 5, and, you know, if there were for want of other options, they may have had poorer careers, poorer lives as a result of just trying to force themselves into a rhythm of work that wasn't for them.
Well, this is it. Everybody is so different, and everybody, you know, performs better at different times during the day. And, you know, why not let people identify that? And it's, as an employer, it works to your advantage. So why would you hinder that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I wish there were more CEOs kind of with your attitude. I think there's still a few folks that are, you know, there is a generational thing. There is people who are used to a certain sort of way of working, let's say. I mean, you can imagine someone who's been been a CEO or an exec at some point, and they've had success in this way of working. Anything other than that is going to be a real difference or a real change. Whereas Occupop, obviously a new business, new startup and all the rest of it, you're just more, I think, malleable and you know, aware of change and opportunity. There's someone actually in the online community there, someone mentioned about, you know, is it okay to send a message on a weekend? And there was a recently interesting conversation going on in the conversation there. And I fell on to the side of, look, I know how I work, and I definitely work every day. However, I'm definitely not doing 8 hours every day. Do you know what I mean? So I think if you look at how I'm operating, I'm probably looking at something work-wise every day. There's never a day when I'm not doing that. But it's generally 2-3 hours at a shot, maybe, you know, 4 hours max or something like this at a chunk. And I'll just check back in. It's not like constantly plugged into the machine. And I find that's just a much better way for me to be, because I've got the time throughout every day to do something else. So there's never any day where it is rock solid work. Whereas other people, you know, they do want to have 3 days completely locked out, not computers off, not looking at email, whatever, but then they're like hyper focused and blasting through. So yeah, I think the winners of this new era are going to be the companies that are able to structure their businesses to operate in this way. Question for you, because it leads on to product a little bit, actually, Caroline. Has any of this thinking about how, you know, the world of work is changing, has that bled into your product development in any way? Have you been thinking about, okay, traditional ATSs have generally been built around this idea of people going to be turning up into the office and do 40 hours a week and then go away for 2 days and then come back next week and do those 40 hours. Like, have you thought about, okay, this new world of work is going to be flexible organizations. Do we then need to actually rethink how to build an ATS?
That's a good point. I think certainly we have been tracking, you know, the market shifts and things that are obviously trending or becoming more important to companies. Like D&I obviously is a huge topic at the moment, and reporting on that. One thing that, you know, we've just recently launched an e-signature feature within our app. So our customers now can run the entire recruitment process online, and that includes getting documents signed or sending contracts signed completely online, which that, you know, was a priority for us, but probably wouldn't have been prioritized quite as much if it hadn't been for everyone, you know, being remote overnight and, you know, not having access to printers and that kind of thing. So, you know, I would say certainly that has dictated our roadmap. You know, when it comes to more abstract thoughts on, you know, how the ATS is built, I suppose we're only really seeing the backlash, the start of the backlash of the pandemic now. Even though, you know, it all happened last year, you know, certainly, like, obviously we track a lot of data with our customers and market data, and, you know, really now we're kind of seeing the effects of that, and they're concerning. It's certainly, you know, I think one of the most difficult times, you know, that I've known anyway in the last 7 or 8 years to recruit. It's extremely challenging. And I think we will continue to see the backlash from the pandemic. And I think probably, you know, as that starts to settle, it will open up more doors and probably give us more, you know, visibility onto to that side of things.
Going on to what OccupyPop is, it's a challenger ATS. It's coming. It's going to help companies. Basically, the core system that companies can use or organizations can use to do their recruiting. It's such a busy market. It's like it's festooned with ATSs. Loads of different things going on there. Again, you just look at the conversation threads that happen in any online recruiter communities. You'll get people saying, "Oh yeah, what ATS are you using?" And then there's like everyone just comments, and there's like 100 different options. Like, how do you choose? How do you make sure that you're in there and in the conversation, Caroline? What were the major challenges to launch an ATS again in this fairly mature market? Like, how did you attack it? How did you think about positioning? How did you kind of get in the door, really, to be seen and used by these customers?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it is a very busy marketplace. And I think, you know, that has its challenges, but it also means as well that, like, you know, there's still so many problems within the market, the fact that it needs to be so busy, which is also a very good thing. You know, for us initially, we probably would have been much wider in terms of the type of customer we targeted. And then, you know, over time, we were able to really, you know, define our positioning and really understand, okay, what is so beneficial about our product? What problems are we solving and who are we solving them for? And that's really the key. Like, who is our audience? And once we, you know, we really got comfortable with, like, as I said before, you can't be everything to everyone, but be something amazing to someone. And that's really what we focus on doing. You know, we're a product that's built for SMEs, so small to medium enterprises. And everything we do, you know, is built around that. Like, our pricing reflects that, our usability reflects that, our features reflect that. And really what we're all about is no fluff. You know, there's a lot of products out there that have, you know, layers and layers of features, and you need, you know, 2 weeks training on the product just to get started. And, you know, it's very difficult to come off it because so much is set up and so many integrations. Whereas our product, it has absolutely everything you need to run your recruitment end to end, but it's so simple and easy to use. No fluff recruitment is what we say. And, you know, we hear that time and again from our customers that, like, you know, setting it up is like setting up a Facebook profile. You're up and you're ready to go. And, you know, you have everything at your fingertips, and it's just so, you know, user-friendly. And, you know, the training involved with getting set up, you know, you could be set up and running within an hour. And you know, SMEs, you know, they don't have huge teams. They're obviously, time is a huge constraint. So being able to get started on a system and get your recruitment process moving quickly is extremely important. So I would say, you know, that's how we cut through the noise. Like, we're just laser focused on, you know, who we serve, who we benefit the most.
You know what? That's a, such a important thing, because you can kiss so many frogs, can't you? If you're trying to do too many things, and you'll end up killing yourself. Because sometimes one of the problems you have is that when you get like hyper demanding customers, they're ultimately demanding because your product isn't quite a right fit for them. Yeah. And you're better off recognizing that and saying, you know what? This other product is better for you. We're focusing here. This is what we do. And then, you know, go with the audience that you care for. As you say, SMB, SME, time poor. They're not going to have like a massive recruiting team. Maybe they don't have a recruitment team. It could just be one person. In which case, this person does not have the time to get massively invested in this huge product. It needs to be a small, light product. They can plug and play and go. Exactly. So all of these things, like if you're aware of it, then that totally then informs your product building, informs your product roadmap, informs how you kind of present it to the market. And ultimately it means that, you know, you're not wasting time addressing problems that other non-customers have, because yes, there are problems they've got, but this isn't a buyer for you. You know, there's other businesses that will cater for it. And I think you're right, Caroline, the fragmentation of the marketplace for ATS is, tells me there's actually many ATSs, and there's many niches for ATSs. It's not just one thing.
There is, and if you look at them, like if you get really close with them, you can see where each of them fit in, and everyone seems to have their own space. So it is an ecosystem, and you know, there's some amazing products out there, and they're really good at what they do, equally as we're really good at what we do in our space.
It's like I take the kind of an ecological analogy here, isn't it? It's like having it's like Darwin's finches. You know what I mean? It's like yes, you're all birds, but you know what? This bird will eat that berry, and this other bird will eat that berry, and it's a different bird. And it will literally ignore each other. They don't address the same. They're trying to address the same problem, but they're doing it for a different audience. And that's a big lesson, I think, for product builders. You can't swallow the entire ocean, not at the beginning.
And the sooner, because it's very hard, you know, at the beginning when you've so few customers, and to turn away a customer, you want the customer numbers. And that can be a really, it's almost like, you know, you're going against your kind of core grain. Like, this doesn't make any sense, but the sooner you learn that lesson, the quicker, you know, the customers will start to come in a lot quicker.
But you know what? That's yet another recruiting skill, isn't it, Caroline? The best recruiters are the ones that can say no to clients.
Exactly.
Because if this person is asking you to do something in a way you don't do, you got to pass that up and say, listen, you could probably work it. You might even place it, or you might even do a deal on it. But you know what? It's going to kill you. It's going to bleed a lot of time out of you. And that's opportunity cost that you can't afford. So
yeah, some of the best recruiters I've worked with have kind of, you know, 10 to 15 core clients. They work with a really small network of candidates, and you know, that has them exceeding all of the targets year on year. You know, they're so selective and so specific, and you need to be almost to the point of being ruthless until you get really comfortable in your space.
That itself is one of the big entrepreneurial lessons that I've learned, is that if you try and say yes, and it's difficult, because sometimes it's a period where the pipeline is weak, and you obviously need cash flow, you need something, and you default to yesing a lot. But every yes to a bad customer is another dagger in the heart of your business. You know, it really is.
Too true.
We need to talk about, I want to talk a little bit about Jenna. I don't want to go on too much about it, Caroline, because, you know, it isn't sort of, I don't get the sense that this is something that you necessarily would push at the front of your self-perception in any way. But it is noticeable from outside in that people who are doing recruitment technology, at least at the founder level, tend to be men. At a very clear kind of gender divide. Even doing Founders Focus is a classic example of this. I think you may be the first woman actually on the show. I didn't even think about this until I was doing it, and I realized it's all blokes here. Why is that? And I just wanted to get your theory as to why you think this is, and is this a problem? And if so, what can be done about it? And if it isn't, you know, why do you think this way? Thoughts on being, I guess, a female recruitment technology entrepreneur?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think in Ireland they're doing a lot at the moment to encourage, you know, female entrepreneurs. Like Enterprise Ireland are certainly at the forefront in you know, promoting female CEOs, female entrepreneurs, and trying to bring more of a gender balance. And like, we've worked with EI in the past, and I, throughout my journey, I've certainly, you know, been exposed to things that I may not have been without that. You know, and along the way I've obviously met a lot of female CEOs, because I'd be in forums exclusively with females. And you know, it's a question that comes up a lot, like, why are there more men than women? And I suppose the cliche, or the kind of the typical response, which I hate to really go with, is that, you know, I suppose the ones that come up the most are kind of lack of confidence, or, you know, parenting responsibilities. And I think, you know, having gone through the parenting side myself, it is definitely very challenging, and it depends what your business is. You know, because my business, like what we do, like a lot of it is online, and I can craft my hours around my life. It works for me. But if you're, you know, in a startup that, you know, requires you to be present in a particular location or working odd hours, like, that can be extremely challenging. You know, if you don't have another support to you know, help with the parenting side of things. So I think it is a challenge. You know, childcare in Ireland is extremely expensive as well, particularly if you're looking for full-time childcare. If you've more than one child, you know, it's a basic salary for one person. You know, it's huge.
Yep.
So I think that also impacts. And lack of confidence seems to come up a lot. And, you know, I think in my case, you know, one thing that I would try and remind myself is kind of to believe in yourself. I think, you know, sometimes I assume everyone feels like this. Sometimes, you know, you feel like you're capable of it all, and other times you kind of have a bit of imposter syndrome. It's like, whoa, how did I get here? What am I doing? And I think, you know, believing in yourself and having the confidence to really stick with it. I know that women, I suppose, in studies that I've read, it has been marked, particularly when it comes to raising finance, that women tend to be traditionally more conservative with their financial forecasts. And I don't know, is that implicating or meaning that, you know, they're not getting the investment behind men who probably are? I know, you know, from our business perspective anyway, like, I would be quite cautious with our budget and our spending. And I think, you know, that actually was hugely successful for us in the end, because when the pandemic hit, we were very lucky to have sufficient runway that we were able to maintain our team. And you know, considering the losses that we did make in the business, we were able to see it through. So yeah, I think it can be a real positive, but you know, whether that is, that kind of cautiousness acts as a negative at the beginning, like the conception stage, you know, could be another hindrance as to why you don't see more. But I do think a lot's been done. I do think we will continue to see an increase in female CEOs. I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to what we talked about with the shift to remote as well, we can anticipate more remote first, remote only startups. And given what you were talking, what we were talking about before about, you know, being remote or distributed really helped you organize your life, and you had you could do other things other than just the work. Maybe that will also be a big factor as well to help female entrepreneurs take that step. You can imagine 18 months ago, if you're locked into a 9-to-5, 40 hours, you got the commute to think about, there's another 10 hours on top of that. Like, what? Where is the time? No one, you know, we shouldn't forget what it was like to kind of wake up before the sun came out, come back completely exhausted. Yeah, have to cook the food. And then by the time you finish that, it's like 8 o'clock in the evening. You want to just go to bed. You know, you don't have any time for anything else. So I think maybe the getting away from the office kind of commute idea may actually be a very significant factor in diversifying the pipeline of entrepreneurs that coming forward.
I also think as well, just on the whole kind of, I suppose, work from home and the impact, I think one thing that I've really enjoyed as well is, you know, whether it's a man or a woman that I'm having like a conference with or a call with, you know, and a child might pop in the background, or you might do something. And whereas I think, you know, before, when you would have had a meeting, if it was online, like, you'd never expect that to happen, or if it did happen, you'd probably be a bit, you know, oh,
well, we've seen people shove the kids off the camera before. Remember that very famous scene where, you know, there's some BBC person was like literally put the face palm this little girl. I thought, leave the child alone.
I know, but it's so acceptable now. And I think as well, you know, particularly if you have, you know, school going children, you know, that are home in the afternoon, you know, and they're able to entertain themselves, but they may, you know, walk by. And the fact that people are so open to seeing that now, I think is a real welcome change, you know, for parents that are, you know, working from home and still trying to maintain a family life.
I think so. I think what's happening is that our perception of what is professional, quote unquote, is starting to erode, which needs to go, because, you know, what professional is, if you think about it, it's very hard to define. And ultimately, it's about washing out your real life. It's like, you need to not be a real person. You need to be this thing in the office that's professional, whereas actually, of course, we're all real people, and of course, exactly. Yeah, things going on, and all of those things are well and good. And as you say, I think it's actually it may actually be a very good way to build relationships. You know, I just wondered, because you get a window into someone's life, you get to see what's going on a little bit, some biographical details and stuff that's going on.
Yeah,
these are like advancements of intimacy, really, that you wouldn't necessarily get if everyone's like just, you know, literally, you know, with the collared up and, you know, being very, very, what's the word, non-transparent with the other stuff going on in their lives.
Yeah, it's bringing a human element back into, I suppose, the corporate environment, and, you know, breaking down those barriers, which I think it helps a lot with, you know, kind of relationships, not only with, I suppose, colleagues, but with customers as well.
This is why I'm going to buy a cat. Not because I like cats, because I think I'm going to strategically deploy this kitten when, you know, I'm in the middle of some sort of meeting, you know, where I need to convert somebody to do something, just get the kitten in there, boom. That's a winner, isn't it? They're going to immediately go, oh, who's that? And I'll say, yeah, it's Oswald.
You got yourself a deal.
Exactly. So listen, folks, do you agree? Having a cute pet might actually be a business advantage, competitive advantage. If you've got a cute pet, a cute kid, even better. But if you have a cute pet, you know, probably more easy to procure. Okay, Caroline, well, there we go. We definitely agree there. Like, you know, everyone's going to have like a little, I don't know, some sort of colobus monkey or something. It's going to help. Okay, no, you can't have colobus monkeys. They're probably not allowed either in Ireland or UK. Let's talk very quickly about roadmap for 2022, Caroline. We're coming so rapidly into next year. What is happening for Occupop? What can customers expect from the product development? What can a non-customer, people who are thinking about it, expect to happen in 2022?
Yeah, well, we've got our finger on the pulse now, and our plans for next year are in full swing at the moment. And a big focus for us is on, I suppose, the communication between the hiring manager and the candidate, so facilitating that, making it easier, you know, to be in contact. We also have a big focus on reporting, so we are building a new reporting module that will include D&I as well. So that's a really big focus for us. And outside of that, we have a lot planned around, I suppose, it's more of the boring stuff, but more around our kind of system infrastructure and how we deliver the service, making sure it's even faster. You know, and building out the core modules will enable us to work on those modules individually and enhancing them even more. So, you know, a lot more feedback from the customers and enhancing those particular modules much quicker, you know, at a much faster pace. So customers will see improvements to the system, you know, coming through a lot quicker. So, you know, that's a really big focus for us for next year.
Yeah, I love that, Caroline, because sometimes we do get a little bit obsessed with feature releases and stuff like this on the front end of it. But in order to get those releases out efficiently to customers, you need to have the infrastructure in such a way that it can be you can easily ship. And the outcome of this, obviously, is a more responsive product for the customer base. You know, if there's a request or a complaint or something like that, you can go ahead and address that straight away. Okay, Caroline, listen, we're coming to the end of the hour. So thank you for sticking with us on this. It's been wonderful speaking with you. Learned a huge amount. And I think there's loads more I'd love to learn from you as well, particularly in terms of, you know, you're thinking about the product and the market and, you know, entrepreneurship in general. So hopefully we'll get the opportunity to do that in a future instance. Before I let you go, what stuff have you got planned for the rest of the day? What kind of important CEOing activity are you doing?
I'm going to catch up. It's halfway through the week, so I'm going to catch up on the sprint, see how we're getting on, and I'm going to jump on customer support and make sure there's no queries there. And yeah, just power on through.
That's amazing. Caroline, it's been a pleasure seeing you. Thank you so much for joining me on Founders Focus.
Thanks so much for having me.
No worries. You have a very good day.
Likewise. Thanks a million. Bye.